Support for Switched on Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must-experience new play. If you only see one thing on Broadway this year, make sure it's Stereophonic, written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler. The play follows a 1970s rock band on the verge of breaking down, breaking up, or breaking through. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of The Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Get your tickets at stereophonicplay.com/fox. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
Nailed that.
Today, we want to look at how musicians push our ears to hear otherworldly sounds. And joining us is Clipping, who are made up of...
Jonathan Snipes.
William Hudson.
Davey Diggs.
You guys got your cues perfectly. Thank you. Clipping are a phenomenal hip-hop group and experts at using both familiar and challenging sounds to make deeply affective music that straddles the line between accessibility and difficulty. And today, we're going to break down their Hugo-nominated single, The Deep, a truly otherworldly track about an underwater civilization birthed from African women who had been tossed overboard from slave ships sailing to the Americas.
Yeah.
This track is truly deep, and I'm sorry for the pun, but it had to happen. But first, as an amuse-bouche, we want to start with things as we always do. We're going to deconstruct a pop track together. And in this case, I think it's going to be really successful because today we're going to talk about Kali Uchis and Tyler, the Creator's After the Storm featuring Bootsy Collins. The sun will come out. So on the surface, I think this track may seem relatively, simple, listenable. But underneath, I think that we're going to hear a lot of things which actually go to much greater depth. Maybe just as an easy question to start off with, what is this song about? You guys want to give it a try?
I think it's about like getting past the tough time in a relationship and getting towards the good time, right? You got to struggle through the storm to have the sun come out.
Beautiful.
Yeah, the sun is literally coming out in New York City as we're recording this. So it seems very fitting.
Exactly. Okay, easy.
Is it a relationship? I feel like the Tyler part makes it sound like there's a relationship, but her lyrics don't sound particularly specific to romantic.
That's true, although the word baby is the only thing that led me in that direction, right? But I guess like if we're hearkening back to the 70s, like all the music is, that's also just like saying man, right?
It's like filler.
It's just two syllables. Yeah.
Bro.
They go anywhere. Baby and B.
Yeah.
It's like saying like or or whatever. Baby.
Baby.
In the piece, she says, we've been struggling endlessly. And what I want to look at is, where are we hearing signs of maybe storminess or struggle happening in this track?
Cool.
I love that key change under Tyler's verse for some reason.
Yeah. Because after the storms, when the flowers blow. Kali, what you mean?
I take it offensive because I'm the hottest flower boy that popped up on the scene. I love like a modulation that leads into a rapped verse where there's no pitch material in the vocal. It's not like it needed to change key for his vocal range or something, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a super jarring shift.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird jarring elements happening in here. Some of the things that I heard were, I guess, a lot of playing with pitch. This song is very pitchy and bizarre. Mm. You can hear it actually in the instrumentation. It's kind of everywhere, right? You have underlying the entire track are these modulated keys that are sort of going in and out of pitch. The sun will come out. Right? You've got sort of a pitch
slow
on the envelope and a modulation of the pitch and the keys. And then you go to the guitars. right? Just like it sounds like wobbly. Everything's running through old tape, right?
Mm-hmm. Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because it feels like music in the 70s sort of sounded like that accidentally because no synth stayed in tune and tape. There was so much tape modulation. And now that's become an aesthetic that we're going for. Like I find we're constantly doing that too. It's just like putting really slow modulations on the pitch.
Right, right.
Just to get everything to keep kind of warm and sort of move around a little bit. Right. Sort of hover and warble.
So as a modern producer, you're basically using an electronic plugin, which is emulating the sound of tape, which goes in and out of pitch.
Yeah, or just having the synth tune itself, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, not even using a plugin to do it.
I want to go to what you said about the pitchiness moves beyond just the soundscape. It actually happens in the structure of the song, right? We move in and out of different keys, like a lot of keys, mm-hmm. like unusual amounts of different keys for a pop song.
Right. You mean more than one?
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, unless you're like Max Martin, you don't do this.
The more I listen to it, the more it sounds like I Want to Be Your Lover, right? Like that Marvin Gaye song.
Mm.
I'm not sure like how much is sampled from there or not, but like it's so in there. Come live with me, angel. Come live with me.
You come far. I want to be your lover.
Which that song did a similar thing. It does move around so much, and there's like rumbling in it, you know?
Rumbling.
I don't know. There's something that feels like storm clouds or something. I don't know, like under the whole shit.
It starts with a big clash of thunder and then rain and
right.
So the storm is like on the nose.
Yeah, yeah.
This song goes all over in terms of key. What allows her to be able to do that? And I think what it is that we've got this underlying repetition. We've got Bootsy Collins' bass line, which is just so fat and really grounds us throughout the entire track to be able to then make aberrations in our direction.
Is he actually playing the
bass? That's what I was just looking at. I think he just does vocals on the top.
Is he really?
I think it's not Bootsy playing
because the beat
bass.
Is by Bad Bad Not Good.
Yeah, so it's the bass player from Bad Bad Not Good.
I assume
who has done a very good job of emulating Bootsy Collins.
I don't know.
Yeah, it definitely feels like Bootsy.
My suspicion is that he yelled some things into a mic and someone else is playing the space bass on this part.
And I did hear that actually Colucci's like, we actually went out to his home studio ranch, which I think is in Ohio,
mm-hmm.
and did hang out and produce this track together. Well, so this is not a phone it in over Dropbox track.
Okay,
so I'm not sure we know.
Even though his voice literally sounds like it's on a phone, which I like.
On a phone.
Chester Hansen plays bass.
Chester
on that
Hansen.
Song.
Thank you for the appropriate fact check.
Bootsy Collins, vocals and songwriting. I guess he wrote his own lyrics.
But maybe we can agree that he's channeling some Parliament
Funkadelic. I would think so.
Yeah. Okay. I want to give Nate an opportunity to share with folks how this sort of idea of a ground repeating riffy bass allows us to do more interesting things. So Nate, you've prepared something for us, yeah?
Oh yeah. We are going to do a brief classical masters digression here. We're exploring now ostinati repetition.
Back up ostinati. You got to define your terms, man.
Right. Sorry. Let me translate my Italian here. So an ostinato is a...
Ostinopodes.
I love using the proper pluralization of ostinato. Ostinatos.
Yeah, right. Panini, panino, ostinato, ostinati. An ostinato is a repeating musical phrase, which is something that we can encounter in music at every period. Sort of, we can go back to the Baroque era. We can go to the 1600s and encounter a composer like Henry Purcell using ostinati in his music. We can listen to what he would have called a ground bass. That was basically the Baroque equivalent of a bass line, a ground bass. A bass line that repeated over and over again. Let's have a listen to this ground in D minor.
Just as funky as the Bootsy alikeness after the storm.
Oh my God, if we threw Bootsy Collins on top of that track,
it'd be dope.
Yeah, baby.
That's probably the most direct through line from after the storm to like the history of Western music. Because in reality, though we have examples like Baroque ground bass, repetition was not a huge part of like the history of, you know, classical Western music.
Yeah.
But when you get to folk music, pop music, then these ostinati repetition becomes like the backbone of so much musical structure, because it becomes something that you can improvise on top of, that you can create grooves with really easily. I kind of want to fast forward now to an artist connected to this track, Parliament Funkadelic.
My favorite band ever of all time.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I think there might, when we get to the deep in the second half of the show, we might find some other points of overlap. We're fast forwarding from Baroque England now to Detroit in the 1970s, but we're going to find the same concept at play. Parliament will take a groove and extrapolate it, sometimes over like a 15-minute track or more. But what it does is it does the same thing. It creates this ground, and on top of that, you can improvise, you can have these different sections. Let's check out a powerful ostinato from the end of Mothership Connection. On the mothership.
All right, that's Bootsy.
Yeah.
That one's for sure.
So in that Parliament track, the repetition grows and has all this variation, but underneath there's something that's still recognizable, something you can latch onto. What's incredible is that you can take these ostinatos and like move them into different contexts. Like we can find Dr. Dre in the 90s taking that same ostinato from Parliament and working it into his track, Let Me Ride. Yeah. But what's remarkable is that you can go forward and backwards in time with these ostinati in surprising ways, because what we're hearing in this Afrofuturist Parliament track is a reference to a spiritual that's been around for centuries, Swing Down Chariot, which is here performed by the Golden Gate Quartet. Let's take a listen to that.
Why don't you swing down, sweet chariot stop and let me ride? Swing down, chariot stop and let me ride. Rock me Lord, come and ease it. I got a home on the other side. Why don't you swing down, sweet chariot?
Man.
In all these cases across time and space, you find that the power of repetition allows you to create powerful new texts. So much of the music we listen to, including this Kaliuchi song, like relies on this specific technique of something repeating and then something you can layer on top of and gradually make it more and more complex and jarring. But because there's something familiar underneath, it remains accessible.
I think it cues up perfectly this idea that Jonathan introduced, that we've got some weird modulation that's happening in Tyler, the Creator's verse. And this is where things start to take a real turn. After the storm, all the way up through Tyler, the Creator's verse, we have just this riff that repeats over and over again. And then we are taken into a totally different direction, because the whole thing just kind of goes and dips down just half a key and pulls us back.
Cause after the storms, when the flowers blow,
Cali, what you mean? I take it offensive, cause I'm the hottest flower boy that popped up on the scene.
And I want to zoom in just... Yeah, okay. I just want to zoom in really closely on that sound, because it's so satisfying. And if that's not enough, we're going to go really, really, really
Whoa.
Close.
Enhance.
So we just got to melt down into Tyler's verse. And it's just, Ooh. It's such a good verse that I think we should listen to the whole thing.
Cali, what you mean? I take it offensive, because I'm the hottest flower boy that popped up on the scene. Feeling better, better than ever, cause your umbrella, umbrella. Sun is beaming on me like headlights beaming on Bambi. Now let's pretend the street is a room and you are a Cameron, cause you draw me candy, the Tito to my Randy. Now let's produce some thrillers, my chocolate with your vanilla,
Does it also get slower, slightly?
Oh, I don't know. What, you hearing that?
Kinda. I wouldn't be surprised.
It may. They slow down the tape. I don't know.
Oh, interesting.
That's what it sounds like. I wonder if it gets slower in relation to the pitch change.
Or is that just an illusion you're hearing?
Because
of the pitch change.
So what's your all take on this verse? What are you hearing?
Well, it's funny talking about ostinati through time, right? Because like so much of what Tyler is doing is referencing other pop songs. So yes. To me, it like feels like Tyler was like, oh, I know what this is. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm gonna put this right in the world where we're trying to be. So like you hear like the Umbrella reference really early on, and then like name and dropping various of the Jackson 5, and then talking about the production of Thriller, right? I really like that about the verse, about like very intentionally connecting this very referential sort of pop song to like a tradition of pop music.
It's awesome that he has these double meanings in which he's both talking about the relationship and citing all of his influences. Just like,
yeah. Even though he's been doing this for so long and he's so great at it, it's all because of when I fell in love with Tyler, right? It's like so weird to hear him rap like this, kind of in this way that is very much about helping people like get into the piece and is like for the piece, as opposed to like all the destruction that he used to bring to tracks, you know, like he had sort of the opposite intent when I first became aware of him, when he sort of brought Odd Future to all of our attention. He's always been a great rapper who could do anything, you know. So for me, because I listen to that stuff so heavily, listening to him pop up on these pop songs is like, it's fun. It's fun watching him do the opposite thing. It's very like inclusive. This is a verse for everybody.
Yeah, I like that you use the word deconstructive, right? The track is almost deconstructed and slowed down to be like, hey, it's changing.
Right.
It's a jarring but really, you know, potent moment about to happen.
And he does have like one of the best voices in rap. Oh, like how deep his voice is.
Oh, yeah.
To have
that
happen where the track slows down and to have that ultra deep voice come in, it's like you slowed her down.
The pitch goes down, the tempo goes down. Well, jury's still out on that one, but we're gonna have to do some beat matching later.
We'll see.
And literally the voice drops to that gravelly deep timbre.
It's like listening to a DJ Screw song.
Totally.
Tyler's just Paul Wall.
Yeah, Tyler's always already screwed.
Sometimes on iTunes, people will leave reviews of the show and they'll always say, oh, Switch on Pop, that's in the show. But man, that Nate Sloan, he's got a deep voice. He's got the best voice. And so I kind of have like vocal dysmorphia about just not being able to meet the quality of Nate's beautiful radio voice. However, it's very clear you've been one-upped on this verse, because I think if you looked at this on an EQ, it would go below human hearing range.
I sound the least like a rapper of any rapper I know to myself, and we're actually constantly struggling with what to mic me with so that I sound more like a rapper, you know, so I get that.
I sit in the baritone range. Better to be a bass or a tenor. Baritone, you're stuck in the middle. Not very useful. So this is not our only modulation. Things get even weirder later on in this song. We eventually transition out of Tyler's verse, we move back up into our key, we get that repeated bass line, that ground bass, that thing which sort of brings us home so that we feel a sense of stability. But the storminess is still there, right? We've got those weird pitchy sounds going underneath. And it would only be appropriate if the song had some resolution where the sunshine came out. And so I want to take us to the bridge.
Nice.
So what happens here, guys? What are y'all hearing? What just happened?
So we have another modulation, right? Another key change?
We did, yeah.
Where did it go? I couldn't even tell if it went up or down, honestly.
Who's got better ears than the PhD here? Anybody?
That's unnecessary, Charles.
We go into the parallel major. We go from A minor into A major, and this is sort of an A major 7.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I got stumped on this on our last episode, too, where we were talking about Ariana Grande. It did the same thing from minor to parallel major, and I couldn't hear it. All right. So now I understand, Charlie. And what I think you're suggesting is that this is literally the sun coming out, right? The switch.
This is the sun.
The switch to the major. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
Exactly. I think, Nate, you put it once that repetition is the spoonful of sugar that allows for more avant-garde and challenging medicine to come out. That repetition gives us the capacity to do these stranger moves on the track. I wanted to check in before we close it out, though, if you're hearing anything else on After the Storm that just stands out to you. I heard lots of references moving in your brain as we were going. Anything else in this track? There's a like deep hidden reference in here that I particularly love.
In the lyrics?
Yeah.
Wait, this is like a scavenger hunt. I don't know. I'm trying to go through them all.
Whatever goes around eventually comes back to you. So you gotta be careful, baby, and look both ways before you cross my mind.
All right, who's got it? Oh, it's gonna hurt when you hear it. All right, here's what it is.
Look both ways before you cross my mind.
Before you cross my mind.
That is the opening track to Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly. That's Wesley's theory.
Yeah.
Sung by...
George Clinton.
But
don't those words also appear in Cinderella Theory, the George Clinton song?
Whoa.
Oh, dang. Do they?
I'm not sure, but that's what I remember thinking when I don't know, Bill looked that up.
I'm looking it up. Hold on.
Whoa, we just broke through.
Okay, I think it's important to know what's happening here. Right? We got Bootsy Collins referencing George Clinton through different tracks, both obviously members of Parliament Funkadelic.
Yeah.
And I think this is important here because, frankly, Parliament's music has become so potent right now, and they are of use in culture. If we look at, obviously, things like Childish Gambino's Redbone being one of the most important tracks of last year, and it's a real throwback and homage to that Parliament sound.
That whole album is...
That whole album, right?
Just one Parliament reference after the other. I love it.
It's crazy, too, because like as we listened to earlier, this is almost like the second P-Funk revival after 90s hip-hop incorporated into so many tracks from Dre, Snoop Dogg, NWA. Now 30 years after that, it's like come back around again. It's really interesting,
and I think it serves as an appropriate transition to talk about The Deep, because Parliament Funkadelic are known for their Afrofuturist narratives, for having underlying their extremely danceable music very political messages, and messages that carry in a long tradition of bringing in sci-fi and fantasy and politics all within a track. And I am so thrilled in the second half of our show to go into your Hugo-nominated track, The Deep. But before we do, we just need to make sure, fact check.
It's not in Cinderella Theory. There's a lot of conversation about where it originated. Everyone says it's from some Parliament song, but no one can find
there
it.
There you go.
Oh, man.
So actually, I don't know.
Oh, man. I know I've heard that before, too. But
we'll get to the bottom of it.
We got to throw it out to the listeners. We got to find the answer to this. The internet forums haven't found it.
Look both ways.
Our professional fact checker here can't find it. So
the truth is out there.
It's out there. We'll get back to it.
Support for Switched on Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must experience new play. If you're anything like us, you're obsessed with music. Not just listening to it, but everything behind the scenes as well. What makes a good band? What makes a great song? And what does it take to make it big? All of these questions and more are explored in the remarkable new Broadway play, Stereophonic. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of The Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler, the story follows an up-and-coming 1970s rock band as they gather in a California music studio to record a brand new album. But it's a bumpy ride that threatens to tear the band apart. You may find yourself being reminded of the famous recording processes for legendary bands like Led Zeppelin, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, and Fleetwood Mac. So get your tickets now and see Stereophonic live on Broadway this spring. Visit stereophonicplay.com/vox for more info. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Welcome back to Switched on Pop. We are now going to talk about Clipping's Hugo-nominated The Deep. I think, like the Kali Uchis track, Clipping really successfully builds complex soundscapes that defy normal expectations of what you're going to hear in a track. And The Deep is a sci-fi narrative with very modern-day themes. What I want to do is try to understand how you built this narrative and how you support it with these non-traditional soundscapes. So let's take a listen to Get the Track in Our Ear.
Tonight, we remember.
Y'all remember how deep it go. Started from the bottom. Y'all remember how deep it go. For y'all had to come back deep. Y'all remember when it used to be deep. So deep. So deep.
So just to begin, could you expand upon the premise of this piece and where you're wanting to take listeners?
Well, I'm never sure like where to start the discussion of this song, right? Because we really wanted, it was about sort of homage to the band Drexia.
Yeah.
And the story that we're telling is sort of based in a mythology that they kind of laid out really over the course of their album art. It was because like those songs aren't very lyric heavy,
right?
But they would sort of tell this story throughout their album covers. So we'd like wanted to place something in that world and continue that mythology and sort of paid homage to that band. Broadly, the narrative is about there is a society of underwater beings who are the descendants of pregnant African slaves who've been thrown overboard during the Middle Passage. And they're existing totally fine underwater, except now we have spent so many years polluting the ocean that it is becoming unsafe for them. And so as they sort of expand upward, as society continues to generate and they need more space and they're expanding upward towards the surface, the toxicity levels are getting way higher. And eventually they need to make their presence known and retaliate in some way. And there are sort of arguments within the society about whether or not that should happen. But what we were really trying to do was make something that would be like the song that is sung every year at like a festival of remembrance of this date when we made our presence known, right? So it was sort of in kind of like a folk song tradition where it's like this gets played at midnight every year on the party to honor the day that the Drexians made themselves like known to the surface world.
So while like the events of the song are sort of could be in our present or our very near future, the singing of the song could be a thousand years in the future or something. So
it's trying to do like a John Henry sort of thing. We were really into that. Right. We were talking a lot about John Henry at the time.
And you use this motif, y'all remember, throughout the entire track as a constant reminder that we're looking backward.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really sorry about this, but I did have to mash up a handful of y'all remembers just to get this in our ear. So here's a y'all remember collision.
Y'all remember, y'all remember, y'all remember, and y'all remember, 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 y'all remember.
I'm sorry about that. I'm really sorry.
I'm out of here.
David, I really like how you use this motif because I think in a different but similar way to the Kaliuchis track, the repetition of y'all remember keeps resetting us and brings us back home because the narrative that you're telling is fairly complex, right? It's going through multi-hundred year histories. It's a complex civilization being built up. There's a revolution, but you keep bringing us back to remembrance. It almost feels like to me, almost like a Homeric retelling story of warfare.
Yeah, totally. And also just to sort of highlight that this is a story that we all know already, right? It's the Passover Seder.
It's like a Seder dinner, is what we said.
I remember us discussing the idea of after every y'all remember having a group of sort of 40 or 50 voices saying, we remember, or something that. Like as if it's like sort of call and response, as if you're, you know, as if it's a storyteller in front of a huge group and really trying to reinforce the ritualness of this, but we abandoned that.
We ran out of time.
So at the beginning of the track, you have the sort of, not the narrator, but almost like this computer voice that first says, we remember. And then David, you come in and you say, y'all remember.
Tonight, we remember.
Y'all remember how deep it goes.
So
That's interesting. We discussed, David, wrote y'all remember as if the only pronoun that that society uses is y'all, that there's not individual.
Right. Yeah, yeah, there's no I. It's all y'all.
It's all collectivity.
Yeah, which I don't really remember why I decided to do that. Was that your idea, Bill?
Yeah, but then I also didn't follow it when I wrote that opening.
Yeah, yeah.
that Naila says.
All right.
I thought it would
she
be
says
fun.
Our mothers.
Right? I know, I totally messed up.
Yeah. We added the intro because This American Life asked for it, right? They asked for some sort of help for the listener to sort of guide them through the narrative of the story and the setup of the story. And so we added the intro with the sort of modulated female voice, sort of as a nod to Drexia, because that's something they do in a lot of their tracks, is they'll have a kind of ring modulated female narrator talking about.
Or like the controller organizing who's what ships are docking. Like,
yeah,
large ocean
exactly.
cruiser number whatever can dock in this place. You know, they've got like over.
We wanted to be able to illustrate where we were physically, right? With the pressure of each place.
Oh, right. That that's why she says all that.
That was a lot of research on Bill's part.
I want to go into exactly this because this piece unfolds in a really fabulous way where there is a tension built throughout the entire track as people are literally rising out of the sea. And each verse, there are significant changes that happen. I want to start just at the grounding, which is really opening in utopia, right? Everybody's dancing around, no one's sweating, right? It's a really beautiful opening.
Y'all remember when it used to be deep? So deep, so deep, ay. When y'all swam about y'all mama while y'all mama was asleep. So deep, so deep, ay. And y'all remember when y'all had the dance floor lit, dark, no two-step deep. Y'all don't even sweat.
I love that last moment so much.
There's an entire Parliament album, Motor Booty Affair, that takes place underwater. And it's all about dancing underwater and not getting wet, which I've always assumed was part of this same mythology. I assume that Drexia and George Clinton were drawing on the same idea, because this idea of a society of either ghosts or actual living, you know, African slaves that have been thrown overboard exists in a lot of different cultures. If you read like Terrell McCraney's work, he talks about the bone people, which is like a reference to stories he was told as a kid. That's the same thing, but everyone's just the bones. All their skin is washed away and they're just bone people walking on the bottom of the ocean looking for their family. So I was very deliberately kind of nodding towards one of my favorite records that also takes place with black folks dancing underwater.
Okay, so these references are running deep. And sorry. That was completely unintentional. But can you share with us a little bit about how you're establishing this underwater world sonically?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, we had sort of decided early on that we wanted the trajectory of the whole song to be this rise to the surface, right? And we start the deepest underwater, and then we end with the breaking through of the surface.
Right.
So we just thought about kind of different ways to do that with sound design. One of the ways was that the track gets gradually faster, right? That each verse is, I think we, you know, start at 65 beats per minute and we end at 120, 130 or something like that.
Well, because what we did first was we programmed the last verse to sound like a Drexia track. And then we just recorded the same drum pattern slower and slower and slower and dropped out certain elements.
And there's a sort of a low pass filter basically on every element that kind of gradually opens over the whole 7 minutes too. So the sounds in the first verse are very sort of dark and deep and filtered and low. And by the time you get to the end, everything's kind of brighter and opened up.
Yeah, the idea was pressure as you're going up makes everything seem faster.
Which is totally not how being underwater works.
No, but it doesn't. It's definitely a metaphor.
But it is how it works in movies.
I feel like we have to hear this for a second. We start underwater in verse 1.
Y'all remember how deep it go? For y'all had to come.
So all the sounds, you said there's a low pass filter. Basically, you've cut off all the highs, and so it just kind of feels underwater. Actually,
And they're played slower. So all of the underwater sounds we sort of recorded at really high sample rates so we could slow them way down and get these kind of large, deep sort of sounding bubbles. That's just Bill blowing into a bowl of water with a straw slowed way, way down.
Oh, wow.
As you were saying, as we rise up, literally the various ships are going up further into the sea. We increase in tempo when we get that what had been this really loose sense of a beat, and we start to feel like, oh, this is a hip-hop track. Who knew? David, you mimic it by the rhythm of your flow increases to build that tension.
So
And y'all was talking how to get up in their heads and got to being real inspired. Circumstances of the birth has got y'all feeling like an army, better yet a navy. And they gone gave y'all the blessing, now y'all going crazy.
We're getting faster. And then finally we rise out of the water and there's no more water.
Y'all remember so deep sunshine. Ride on. Y'all remember so deep sunshine. Ride on. Y'all remember when y'all had to let him breathe. Ride on. Aye.
Oh.
Yeah, and that's the breaking through right there.
Oh,
that's why you hear seagulls.
It's actually an Arctic tern.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
Oh, that moment at the very end is like cresting.
And then the tidal wave, yeah.
Breaking the waves. And okay, I get it now. Wow.
That's fabulous. Okay, so we've risen up. We've come out of the water. Flow's getting faster. What other elements are important in establishing the soundscape for you?
We're usually not so prescriptive with our sound design. Like usually the sound design is a little more acousmatic, right? That we're more interested in what the sounds are rather than what the sort of extra referential associations with the sounds are. But this time we really wanted everything to sound like it was underwater, have some interaction with water.
Part of that has to do with, usually the sounds we use are much more abstracted from their reference, right? So the idea is, if we use the sound of breaking cinder blocks, the song is not about breaking cinder blocks, right? But in this case, the reason we were doing this was because this was commissioned by This American Life as a segment on their show. And they really wanted the storytelling to be very clear.
Right.
They were worried that our songs are usually too obscure and that people listening, just tuning in on the radio and hearing it once, needed to be able to follow it sort of. So I think we did make this a lot more thematically watery in our sound design than I think we would have usually done.
It got to a point where we actually had to push back, right? We were like, actually, we're not doing any more to make this clear. Like, there is a difference between a song and a story on the radio, and I think people will understand it. But like, there were like discussions over the process where they like kept asking for clarity, and we were like, we think it's clear enough. We think we got there.
I think we did most of their notes.
Oh yeah,
I think.
They were generally very good notes, actually.
Didn't Ira want us to cut the line about not sweating, actually? That's funny.
Oh, yeah.
He wanted us to cut something in the first verse that we refused.
Yeah. Well, it was for time, right? It was like the first verse felt a little bit too long.
It was for time,
It was just like it was like two bars in the first verse that he's like, I don't think this is really propelling the narrative forward. And we're like, but we need it to be symmetrical. And it wouldn't...
It would have been a seven-bar verse or something weird.
Yeah.
I liked imagining Ira Glass as a hip-hop producer. Just like, he's going to start working with like...
So our impresario, Dr. Dre.
Be like, I don't know, I think you should change Gucci Gang. Gucci Gang, really?
Yeah, they could have got that note. I really like how you all are... You use what is a very... the narrative does take us in a very clear place. Am I able to follow where you're going? And yet you're able to include some sounds in here which are incredibly jarring, very powerful. I wanted to play a couple of sounds that come out in this track that in context, you're like, oh yeah, for sure, that's what's happening. Hmm. But if you just heard this anywhere else, you're listening to some like really intense like death metal or something. Finally, everything explodes. Those are some terrifying sounds. Like, absolutely terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
I guess what I'm hearing is that by providing us this really clear narrative, you're able to insert these more challenging and interesting sounds. You all do this throughout so many of your tracks, where the underlying production has I feel like a really deep narrative connection to what David is saying, and oftentimes are sort of like, they are affective, and that I find them both challenging and acceptable at the same time. So I don't know, I just wanted to share, I think you do that very, very effectively.
Thank you. Yeah, I do think these are the most justified weird noises we've ever used. They're there to tell the story, so we got to make them, but often we just make horrible sounds that aren't justified, that just pop on in a track.
I really like when you use alarm clocks and turn up the synthesizers. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and usually we could just get to say, well, we like the way that this sounds aesthetically, like in the same way that you would choose a guitar tone, right? Or dial up a synthesizer patch or something. But in this particular case, we had to say, well, how will a listener interpret this sound narratively?
I want to ask you about one more sound, which is the song, even though we are sort of moving from the beat is so slow, you don't even know if you might just be listening to spoken word, right? And then eventually you get up and clearly we're listening to a hip hop track. And I think one of the things you do to ground us there is we've got a hook. So what is this hook, and what is the purpose of including it in a song, which is, as you said, intentionally extremely narrative?
What is the sound itself?
Yeah, first, what's the sound?
Oh, bell, the bell
yeah.
sound?
Yeah.
So that's, if you take apart a hard drive, there are these little metal discs inside of it.
Who knew this would be so rewarding?
That make this really beautiful ring.
And they have a very particular pitch, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. I think they're B flat.
I love that computers were tuned to B flat. That makes the jazz PhD very happy.
Yeah, right. And I had been sort of taking them apart and kind of figuring out what to do with a bunch of old dead hard drives that I was trying to do something.
Well, because we recorded breaking them for a different thing. We made like a bunch of clicking, like any hard drives that
like
were broken.
You, if you start like a broken hard drive that's sort of clicking and stuttering, if we were recording those and like starving them power and getting them to kind of
and
like
dragging. We did a whole thing where we'd expose the disc and then I would drag like paper clips on them and or like different pitches.
Yeah,
and
like if you
we did dry ice too.
A little screwdriver or something on the exposed spinning disc to sort of make these sounds. So we had all these discs that we had actually used some of them in the drum kit that we had built when we were on Conan.
Oh yeah,
that's right.
To do Aramal, because we built a drum kit for our friend Shakuti to play out of just sort of found materials, and there were a lot of, because it ended up that those particular discs were in the key of that song Aramout totally accidentally. Anyway, so we recorded striking these discs with mallets and then quickly dipping them into water in a sort of
so the pitch bends
like Toru Takemitsu or John Cage style, because the pitch bends on a resonating material like object as you dip it slowly into water. I thought it'd be kind of interesting to make a sampler instrument out of a ton of these, right? So that the initial pitch is the key that you're playing on the keyboard, but that it modulates as it bends into the water, and each note is a different. We recorded, I don't know, a dozen of these or 20 of these or something, so that each time you play a note, it sort of round robins through them. So it's never the same sound over and over again, but it has this weird kind of pitch bend on it, no matter what note you're playing. And that's the instrument that's playing that.
You are some crazy mad scientist.
Very Drexia inspired melody too. I think that kind of little descending minor key thing is something
it sounds like Hydro Cubes.
Yeah.
I think the Drexia track that kind of sounds like.
David, what does the hook do for you in supporting the narrative?
I think it's just a chance to like bring it back to the sort of call and response nature of the thing that we were trying to have. If we had had time to do that idea to get 40 voices responding to the Y'all Remember, you know, it would have been that moment. But it's that point in the party. And also, like, it is, like you said, it's a rap song. Because we do so much that is in some ways challenging to how rap songs function, we generally structurally are not that challenging, right? So like the vast majority of our songs are verse, hook, verse, hook, verse, hook.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We're playing with that a little more these days, but that was intentional early on because we wanted to make sure everybody still recognized these as rap songs. So we were doing things that rap songs do.
Yeah.
And then... yeah, this was the same thing.
That reminds me of, similarly, Trent Reznor was always deliberate in trying to create really challenging industrial music to always use pop song formats. Mm-hmm. And it's unsurprising that Nine Inch Nails makes it onto the pop charts and, you know, had overwhelming successes because underneath what are some challenging sounds is a nice little pop structure.
Although it's funny, you think of his most successful song, Closer, has like a 3-minute instrumental outro, which is pretty
which
unusual
is
for
weird.
A pop song.
There's got to be a radio edit or something.
I love that approach in clipping in general, and it seems especially effective for this song because it is like you're looking through a watery mirror at a society that like might in some way resemble our own. You know, they have, you know, hooks and choruses and instruments that sound familiar, but you can't quite put your finger on them. And that hard drive dipped in water is a perfect example of that, where you're like, I think I know what this is, but I might also have no idea.
It's also very similar to the Kali Uchis with like this whole, I mean, it's a storm coming to sunshine, we're underwater coming to sunshine. All this pitch bendy stuff is always about like wateriness. It's like a metaphor for water.
Yeah.
if this weren't on a mount, I would have dropped the mic, because that's exactly what I was hoping we would find that connection.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I do it too fast?
No, that was...
we'll just cut it. Cut that and put it at the end.
Just you'll like edit we it to the end it. Of the thing. Yeah.
I want to ask just one more question about the deep. And if you'd like, we can cut it, because sometimes you don't want to reveal too much.
Oh, we're pretty transparent.
Okay. Yeah. There is an online debate about what happens in the end of the deep.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. I haven't noticed that.
And I thought it would be nice, maybe we could settle the debate, or if you want, open the debate even further. At the end of the song, there is this giant tidal wave that supposedly takes over and smashes all of the humans, right? And ends that civilization. However, the very last line of the song says that we're going to let them breathe. And there's this sort of very powerful moment, David, that you choose to make this connection where the underwater population sees the roots of their history in the above water population. And so some people online just thought, well, if you're going to let them breathe, maybe you're actually saving them from the tidal wave. What's actually happening here?
Well, I don't know if we decided if everyone dies or if it was just like a show of force, you know? Yep. We tend to also, the three of us tend to have different interpretations of what happens in our songs. But in my opinion, like it was a show of force and a lot of people died. Mm. Let them breathe, to me, was about drowning them, essentially, because they breathe water, right?
Right.
So, but it's also a reference to another clipping song to air them out.
Yeah.
Which was also why we threw those Ride On Them overdubs in there, because that's also from that song. And it was sort of a way of connecting our two like Afrofuturist works to one another. And like, I do a lot of things sometimes to like leave ourselves open to maybe connecting things later if we wanted to, not that we necessarily ever would. But this way, like there was sort of a direct connection between those two worlds. So if we were to want to like make a story song that for some reason connected Splendor and Misery to this world, that this would be an opportunity to do that. Not that we would ever necessarily do that.
I love thinking about our songs as, and I, this is sort of something we developed really while doing the Splendor and Misery album, as primary sources, right? As opposed to interpretations. So we all have different stories of the narrative of Splendor and Misery. The three of us all have different ideas about what happens to that character. I mean, with it's a lot of overlap and a lot of similarities.
But it's important to us that we actually kind of disagree on what we think happens.
But also that those all three of those interpretations could be true, right? Given the primary source evidence that we have, which is the album we made. Right? That like when you reconstruct then what actually happened, that these all make sense, that you could connect these lines, And I think the deep is kind of
each of our readings is available, but
which in turn means that like
they don't necessarily
everybody
agree.
Else's reading on the internet is possible too. I mean, except the dumb ones, but
all interpretations are good, but the bad ones. I like that this leaves you open to potentially be the Asimovs of Afrofuturist hip hop, in which you decide that at some point in your career, like, oh no, everything was connected, and just go back and sort of like weave it all together over many generations and tens of thousands of years. It's possible. Just put it out there.
I mean, it's nice to have options.
You all have lots of projects going on right now. I was wanting to see what's going on for each of you and what's going on for Clipping.
I actually don't think we can even... Is there anything we can even announce as Clipping or talk about?
We have a reissue of our first release. It will have just come out.
Nice.
Our first untitled tape that we did for our friend's label, Death Bomb Arc, in what year was that?
It came out in 2012.
So we did a vinyl reissue of that with some new remixes and...
Great.
Yeah.
Check out Blind Spotting if it's not out yet either when this comes out. So July 20th or 27th, depending on where you live, there's a movie that I co-wrote with a good friend of mine and Clipping collaborator at times.
Nice.
And I assume that you all are maybe working on some music on the side. We hope that you'll want to come and join us again when the next Clipping work comes out.
We are working, but we
don't know when it's happening. Yeah. But it's
there's
for
no
sure.
schedule for that.
And not only can we not announce it, but we can't announce it because we don't even know.
Right on. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining us on the show. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Thank you.
Thanks, we're big fans. It's really exciting.
This episode of Switched On Pop was produced by me, Charlie Harding.
And me, Nate Sloan.
We are mixed and engineered by Bill Lance, designed by Luke Harris. and we are a proud member of the Panoply Network.
You can find more episodes at switchedonpop.com. Reach out to us there. contact@switchedonpop.com. Twitter, switchedonpop.
And we'll be back in again with another episode in 2 weeks. And until then, thanks for listening. And thanks to you guys. It has been so much fun having you on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks again.
Thanks, yeah. That was great.
Support for Switched on Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must experience new play. If you only see one thing on Broadway this year, make sure it's Stereophonic, written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler. The play follows a 1970s rock band on the verge of breaking down, breaking up, or breaking through. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of the Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Get your tickets at stereophonicplay.com/fox.